This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm Margo Patterson, the producer of this week's show. It's December 24th, and I'll be talking to Sammy Awad in Bethlehem about what Christmas is looking like there this year and about his work with the Holy Land Trust, a Palestinian NGO that focuses on building peace through personal transformation. But first, news.
Last week, a Palestinian couple was attacked by Jewish settlers bursting into their home at 4 a.m. and at least one posing as an Israeli soldier. 55-year-old Wa'il Mohammed Makbal suffered fractured ribs and his 46-year-old wife, Samia, required medical attention after inhaling pepper spray. The assailants vandalized the couple's home, car, and tractor and broke the windows of a nearby neighbor's home. The attack was one of several that took place in Palestinian villages near Nablus, with settlers attacking Palestinian homes and cars, and in one case, attempting to abduct a local resident. The attacks occurred hours after a 25-year-old Jewish settler, Yehuda Dementman, was killed in an ambush by Palestinian gunmen close to a nearby settlement outpost in the occupied West Bank. No group has claimed responsibility for the shooting, and Israeli authorities are conducting a manhunt.
The Israeli newspaper Haaretz is reporting new plans to build Jewish neighborhoods and housing complexes in occupied East Jerusalem that would entail the eviction of Palestinian residents. The newspaper reports that the Custodian General's Unit within the Israeli Justice Department is promoting plans for five new Jewish neighborhoods in occupied East Jerusalem, home to the city's Palestinian residents and where Palestinians have long hoped to establish the capital of an independent Palestinian state. Conflict over the eviction of Palestinian residents from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem fueled the 11-day war in May between Hamas and Israel.
2021 was the deadliest year for Palestinian children since 2014, according to the documentation collected by the Defense for Children International. The grassroots movement for children's rights reported 86 children killed in the occupied West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and occupied East Jerusalem. 67 children were killed in the 11-day May war between Israel and Hamas, 60 by Israeli military forces, and 7 by rockets misfired by Palestinian armed groups operating within the Gaza Strip during that same time period. Another 15 children were shot and killed by Israeli occupation forces operating the West Bank, and 2 children were killed by armed Israeli civilians.
My guest today is Sammy Awad, founder of the Holy Land Trust, a nonprofit Palestinian organization committed to fostering peace, justice, and understanding in the Holy Land, and exploring and developing solutions to the root causes of violence. The Holy Land Trust is located in Bethlehem, and we're going to be talking this hour about Bethlehem, about peace, and about hope. Sammy Awad, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, and Merry Christmas wishes to everyone from Bethlehem.
Well, thank you. This program, as you've just acknowledged, is airing on Christmas Eve here. It's a busy season, I'm assuming, there as well. What is this Christmas like in Bethlehem? I've heard that tourism is down because of the pandemic and the city is hurting because of that. Despite the Christmas holiday, is this an anxious time in Bethlehem?
Yeah, as everyone knows and everyone has suffered through the last 2 years, Bethlehem, like many places around the world, has suffered from the COVID pandemic that we all face. And it has really, really affected Bethlehem more than many other Palestinian cities, specifically because Bethlehem greatly depends on tourism as a major source of its income. If it's hotels, restaurants, souvenir shops, tour guides, and of course, all the people working in this field. Last year was quite a sad Christmas in Bethlehem, the first Christmas where almost nobody showed up. And because the pandemic was in its first year also, there was so much fear that people did not go out. The cities were empty. The streets were empty almost completely. This year, there was a sense of optimism a couple of months ago that tourism will come back. Hotels started cleaning up and opening up, souvenir shops, cleaning their items and preparing them. But I guess with this new wave of the COVID, things have shut back down again. But we are seeing quite a number of locals move around the city more than usual. And Palestinians who are living inside Israel, Palestinians who are living in other areas are coming in to see the Christmas tree that was lit a couple of weeks ago and to see the decorations. So there is a little sense of aliveness in Bethlehem compared to last year. But of course, nothing compared to what Bethlehem should be like during this time, with thousands and thousands of tourists filling the hotels and celebrating Christmas in Bethlehem.
Bethlehem is a historically Christian town. Over the last decades, the Palestinian Christian community has declined in numbers, and the city is now about 70% Palestinian Muslim and 30% Palestinian Christian. But by law, the mayor of Bethlehem is always Christian. I'm wondering if that creates any tensions between Christians and Muslims in Bethlehem. I'm also curious about the different Christian denominations in Bethlehem. There's quite a range. Do they get along? And is there one church that has far more members than the others?
In terms of Christian-Muslim relationships, one thing that we are really proud of in the city, and I would say as Palestinians overall, is the good relations between Christians and Muslims overall within the Palestinian community. When I said before, locals coming to visit Bethlehem to see the tree, what I mean is actually 99% probably are Muslims coming to visit Bethlehem during this time. And you see Muslim shops putting up Christmas tree and decorations as well. So this is a celebration that is considered a celebration for all. The birth of Jesus is for us the birth of the Messiah. For Muslims, it's the birth of also a highly renowned prophet for them. And so it is a celebration. Muslims go into the Church of Nativity and pray in the Church of Nativity and honoring Jesus as well. And so there isn't tension within the Palestinian Muslim communities. This said, there is always and growing tension happening just because of the political situation that we are living in as Palestinians. As you know, and the listeners know, as Palestinians, we live under an Israeli military occupation. We are restricted in our movement. We are restricted in our ability to even expand our cities. The areas of land allocated to the Palestinians to build, for example, are the same areas that were allocated to us in the 90s. And so there is congestion, there is street congestion, there is traffic, there is growing numbers of population. Also the amount of water that we get is also limited because the Israeli authorities control the water. So these tensions are there. And sadly, sometimes they overplay within the community itself. People who are living in tension all the time find ways to reflect this tension against each other. And this is something that we are really worried about, especially in cities like Bethlehem, because Bethlehem, unlike other Palestinian cities, is a very closed, tight city surrounded by settlements, surrounded by the separation wall, surrounded by land that is controlled by Israel. And so it's becoming more and more difficult to travel, to move around. Just to give you an example, 5 years ago when I used to take my daughters to school, it was a 5-minute drive. Now, the same distance takes me at least 25 to half an hour daily. So just you could imagine that and what tension that creates for people. So we are always worried that this tension can turn into violence and can turn into violence between communities in the Palestinian areas, in Bethlehem and other areas. But so far, and thankfully, this hasn't happened. People are really aware of this. In terms of the denominations, yes, I mean, this is the Holy Land. And any denomination that you could think of probably exists in some level in this Holy Land and Bethlehem. The biggest two Christian denominations here are the Greek Orthodox, which is the biggest Christian denomination, followed by the Catholics, the Latin Church. And these two pretty much together total over 70% actually of the Christian population. The rest, which is the Armenians, the Assyrians, the Lutherans, the Anglicans, the Evangelicals, and many others will be the rest of that population. And again, for the most part, there is no tension between these denominations other than it's quite a joke because some of them are very just strict in their practices. And the tension is just how these Christians practice their rituals that may be rituals that are not practiced by other denominations. But this is a historic battle between Orthodoxy and Catholicism that is outplayed here. But it doesn't turn into any form of resentment or hatred or violence, of course.
Well, quick question. I know your uncle, Alex Awad, is a United Methodist missionary. Is that true of all of your family, that they're Methodists?
I have an aunt who's an Assyrian. My uncle Alex comes from a Methodist background, but he was the pastor of a Baptist church here. My uncle Mubarak Awad, who was a Palestinian activist in the 80s and deported by Israel, is a Quaker. We have Catholics, we have Orthodox, and yes, Evangelical Pentecostal as well within our family as well. So we spread the spectrum of the denominations within our family as well.
Well, let me ask you about the Holy Land Trust. The website says it is neither a political nor a religious organization, but an organization focused on personal transformation and addressing the spiritual trauma that prevents a just and lasting peace. So two questions. First, the Holy Land Trust is now more than 20 years old. How did you come to start it? Second, how and why is personal transformation key to a just and lasting peace, in your opinion?
I started Holy Land Trust in 1998. It was after a time when I came back from the U.S., where I was very excited, like many people around the world, about a peace process that was happening here called the Oslo Peace Process. Palestinians and Israelis were negotiating an end to the conflict, an end to the occupation, and establishing peace in a framework called the two-state solution. One state for the Palestinians, one state for the Israelis, and we were going to live happily next to each other till kingdom come. This was the idea. This was the plan. So I came back from the U.S. excited to be part of this peace process, to do what I can do in bringing peace and building a democratic Palestinian state. The reality struck me very quick that what was happening in the negotiations was not peace. What was happening in the negotiations was, yes, there was negotiations, but there was deep mistrust between the two negotiating sides, and both sides were negotiating, I would say, out of fear and the need for security and preservation, not the peace that we all believe should happen here, which is peace that is founded on trust and respect and recognition and honoring the other to be present in this land that we all love and we all call holy. And so I started the organization to play a role in the peace process, to see how can we make this peace process really tangible, really viable, really connected to the communities of this land. Not just politicians negotiating deals between them, but the people need to be involved in this. This is why our slogan, strengthening communities for the future. We believe that no matter what the politicians decide, if the communities are not convinced, that peace may last a little longer, but it will not last for good. Something will end up breaking it if the communities don't believe in it and are embedded in it. And so we started our work. The three tenets of our work are a full commitment to nonviolence. We believe that nonviolence is a mean to end violence, to end oppression, to end occupation, to end conflict. We've been training and promoting nonviolence since day one. This is a cornerstone of our work. The second pillar that we engage in is the pillar of healing. One thing that we feel has been neglected continuously during the years and decades of negotiation is a deep understanding of the collective trauma of the peoples of this land. We've just created this assumption that this side is violence and that side is violence, and because they come from this religion, they're violence, or because they come from this nation group, they're violence. Nobody's born violent, and we know this. We're all created in God's image, no matter who we are. And there are some things that transform people to become violent, if it's from theology, from training, or from experiences. And one thing we know is that both Palestinians and Jews in this land and outside of this land have suffered tremendously. We cannot ignore and neglect the Jewish suffering for millennia. For over 2,000 years, Jews have suffered and have been neglected and marginalized. And of course, the Holocaust was the high point of Jewish suffering and the experience of genocide. And the Palestinians continuously suffer trauma, collective trauma, from 1948 until this day. We have committed ourselves to saying that there really cannot be peace between communities that are traumatized. Just like two people who are traumatized cannot make peace with each other, communities cannot make peace with each other. So we've developed programs to bring an understanding of collective healing trauma to our communities. The awareness that we are traumatized alone helps us to understand how we behave, how we make decisions, and how we can relate to the other. And this is why personal healing becomes a very important part of our work. The third tenet is transformation. Transformation means we need visionary leaders. We need leaders on both sides that are able to look to the future, are able to see the future, in a way, what I would call prophetic leaders in this land, not leaders who are able to just manage the situation, or sadly, many leaders we have, again, on both sides, who are gaining power by promoting fear of the other. And they're saying, we are the ones that are able to defend you. We're the ones that are able to bring you security. Fear the other and trust in us. This is leadership that for me has failed us continuously. And so we've developed also programs to try to build visionary leaders for the future, working with men and women, working with Israelis and Palestinians, with activists, young adults, religious leaders. We work with everybody actually here to try to engage in this nonviolence, healing and transformation work. And so for us, we say, yes, we're not political. We are a non-governmental organization. And we believe that non-governmental organizations shouldn't be involved in the political debate in terms of what the political solution should be. We should be concerned about human rights. We should be concerned about civil rights. We should be concerned about promoting trust and respect between the communities. And then from that, we believe that actually the right political solution will emerge. When people really learn to respect and love each other, I think we will see an amazing political framework in this land that maybe nobody has even thought of.
How do you go about addressing the spiritual trauma that so many people in the Holy Land have suffered, in which you've just spoken about? How do you promote healing? How do people heal, in fact?
We have developed several programs. One program that we really engage in deeply is a program that we also developed with Israeli partner organizations. It's called Healing Hatred. And it addresses the trauma by engaging in the ability of people to come together, to listen to each other, to share their stories of pain to each other, not their political views, but what they experience personally as pain. And then from that, we move into the next level, which is connecting the personal to the collective. Many times when we are suffering, we think we are the only ones that are suffering. And it feels like this. We feel isolated. We feel that nobody cares. We feel that the world is ignoring us. When you begin to hear stories of others that are similar to you, you develop a sense of empathy and compassion for them, even as you are suffering. You begin to see the other in you. And so we do a lot of what we call mirroring of trauma to each other, that each side can really begin to see. Yes, we understand there's a power dynamic, but we know that this conflict has caused suffering on both sides. And so when people begin to hear this, they begin to engage differently in how they're connecting and how they're sharing and how they're speaking back into their community. This is why we emphasize a lot of our work. We like to do it with community leaders, men and women who are in leadership position who can influence. And what we've seen is that people who have taken our programs change the discourse of their language, of their conversation in their community. They're not promoting fear anymore. They're not promoting hatred anymore. They're promoting understanding. They're promoting listening. They're promoting compassion, even within their own community. This is very important. It's not an easy process because the reality we live in is that violence continues. Usually, trauma healing is a PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. This is when, after the conflict, we engage in healing. The challenge for us is that we are trying to engage in it as we are continuously experiencing the occupation and its violence. But slowly, slowly, we're seeing the transformation happen in these leaders that take our courses.
We can talk about trauma, we can talk about suffering, but there's also historical grievances that I think accumulate. And I think people are often very unwilling to give up their grievances. Is there anything that needs to happen for people to be willing to do that? And how do you affect that sort of basic question of will?
It's very, very challenging, especially when you bring in religion into it as well. And what we've seen, of course, over the centuries is how trauma is no longer seen as an experience that people had, but as a key component of identity itself. So, for example, when we talk about Jewish identity is very, very much linked, modern Jewish identity, for example, with the Holocaust, with those who have survived the Holocaust and the aftermath of the Holocaust. And so the Holocaust is deeply shaped now, not just in the generation that experienced the Holocaust, I would even say more embedded in the generations that came after. That narrative of trauma has become the shaper of identity. This is where we believe spirituality comes in and plays a role, because for us, spirituality is what connects us together as human beings. The fact that, yes, these experiences, I say religious because they've even almost become sort of as a historic religious experience for many of these communities, bringing religious leaders to engage in this work and to engage in their own healing space. When we say healing, it's not about negating, it's not about deleting. You know, the wounds are there, but it's understanding how we relate to them, how we use them in our decision-making. A big part of what we do our training with is to train people, and I'm saying this very, you know, and it sounds very shallow, but the courses that we give are 6 months intensive trainings that people go through. But it's about how you can develop your mindset where you begin to learn to honor and respect and learn from the past, but be able to make your decisions in the present based on the future you want to create, not the past that you experienced. Most Palestinians and most Israelis want to live in peace and security. This is something that we all understand and the world needs to know. This is not a black and white thing as many people perceive it. The majority of the people want to develop, want to have economic sustainability, want to be able to travel, want to be able to work, want to be able to go to hospitals without checkpoints, without any restrictions. The majority, the greatest majority of Palestinians, there are elements that are extreme. And we know this, they exist everywhere. In the US, they exist. And in Europe, they exist. But we believe that when peace comes to this land, these elements will be as marginalized as they are in many communities as well. And so working with religious leaders, dealing with spiritual healing and trauma becomes also very important. I'm not saying this as if we're making miracles happen here, but this is what we believe needs to happen. And what we're seeing, that this language that we started using 10, 15 years ago, that was quite new, and I would even say quite rejected by many, including within the NGO communities that engage in peace work, more and more is becoming mainstream language. That the idea of healing trauma is being spoken more than ever before. And again, I say healing is not negating, but to say that the circle of violence, revenge, and retaliation has not done anything for us as peoples of this land. And using theology and using historic texts to claim something more than the other has not helped us as well. This land has experienced every religion dominating it at one point. And whatever religion that is dominating in any moment thinks it is the religion that has the right to dominate, and God gave them that right. We had the Crusades come here, and they believed it was a mandate of God, the Christians, that this land becomes theirs. And then the Muslims came, and God told them to take the land. And now the Jews came, and there's theology that says God told them to take this land. Do we have to wait for the next religious group or one of the previous ones to take power again, become more powerful and take over the land, and thousands will be killed? Most people here do not want that. Most people here do not want war. Religious leaders do play a key role in bringing this new consciousness into this land.
Well, the Holy Land Trust is committed to nonviolence, as you've just explained. What do you say to those people who say that the PLO's decision to pursue a diplomatic track with Israel has just not paid off for Palestinian people in any way, that Israel just keeps gobbling up more and more Palestinian land, seems bent on maintaining its military occupation, and is completely uninterested in peace? I would think a lot of people might look at the situation and say, that's just the reality. Nonviolence has just not worked for the Palestinians.
The only real experience of nonviolence that we've had was during the first intifada, the first uprising in 1987. And that led to my uncle being deported as a nonviolent leader. Nonviolence was so strong and so threatening to the system of power that my uncle Mubarak was actually declared by the Israeli government as a threat to its national security. and therefore was deported. The only nonviolent leader to be deported from this land, never allowed to return and live here. And so, yes, nonviolence is powerful. At the same time, we always say nonviolence is not a magic wand. We've had many examples around the world where nonviolence has failed, and many more examples, actually, where violence and armed resistance has failed. And this is, you know, according to research and statistics, armed resistance and violence has succeeded less than nonviolence. At the same time, I also say negotiations is not nonviolence. Negotiations is negotiations, especially at the political level. And this is where many people get confused. They think that just by people sitting across the table from each other negotiating, this is nonviolent. No, this is called negotiations. And I think we failed miserably in negotiations. And I think our leaders failed miserably in negotiations. Whether purposely or not, it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, as Palestinians, many people actually say we are in a more difficult situation than maybe before the peace process began. At least we had freedom of movement then. We didn't have checkpoints. We didn't have this wall. People used to work and bring income into their communities. Yes, we were restricted on many other things, of course. But the situation is very, very challenging. And as I said before, one of the reasons why the negotiations failed is because they were not negotiating peace. They were negotiating position. They were negotiating power dynamics. And we had one side which is much more powerful that always set the discourse of negotiations and what happens in these negotiations. Our Palestinian leaders were promised things that were not met. Our leaders also, I think, really did not understand the complexity of how to engage in these negotiations in productive ways.
Sammy, I think around the world, everybody is seeking personal transformation. Is there one critical ingredient to personal transformation?
I would say the one critical ingredient is your mind, to begin to really listen to yourself and to listen to how you are having conversations within your mind, and most important, how you're making decisions within your mind. The average person has between 70 and 80,000 thoughts a day. Many of these thoughts actually deal with decisions. I'm sitting here talking to you, and almost every word or every sentence is a decision that I'm making to speak it. And I'm speaking to you, and you're deciding if you like what I say, you don't like what I say, it makes sense, it doesn't make sense. So the mind is continuously functioning and making decisions. And what motivates us to make our decisions is the past. If you go to a restaurant, for example, and you have a bad meal in that restaurant, you're smart enough not to go to that restaurant again. Your past guides you and helping you make a decision not to go to that restaurant again. What we are encouraging people in this training to do is to begin to understand this. I'm understanding that my decision is coming from the past. When we say, for example, peace in the Holy Land is impossible, of course, it makes sense to say it's impossible. Why? Because the past informs us of the violence of the wars. How can we make peace with them? And look what they did to us. Both sides say this. And so we're deciding not to make peace. We're deciding not to engage with the other because of the past. And so the consciousness work of transformation is to begin to create this awareness in that moment that, I'm allowing the past to enter and make my decision. How can I, again, honor it? Respected, but maybe I can actually make a decision independent from the past based on the future I want to create, not the past that I experience. And this is the course that we're training, and it's called nonlinear thinking. So my encouragement for people is just to be aware of their thinking. The moment you become aware of your thinking, then you will experience transformation.
Sammy Awad, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Well, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you and to all the listeners.
You've been listening to Understanding Israel-Palestine on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.